was called The Memoirs of Maurice Paulogue, who was the last French ambassador to the royal court. And I was lucky enough when I took my French baccalaureate examination to pull the question out of the hat with about a dozen or probably two dozen other questions. And the question that I had to respond to was, describe France's role in the Russian Revolution. So I've been always very grateful to the fascination that I had with Rasputin. Want to truly thank PwC. Randall Justice, a member of our board, just came back from Italy, so he cannot be with us, but he is represented by his partner, Cameron Motes, who I learned worked with, worked with Randall in Moscow for a number of years. I believe we have students here tonight, and I'm not wearing my contacts, so I have to try to get used to these transition glasses. So we have students from Hockaday, yes, we do, and from St. Mark's. Great to see all of you, and thank you so much for being here. And that gives me the opportunity, too, to thank, I recognize some faces of letters that I recently signed, those of you who supported our special appeal this year for the annual fund. We did finish the year positively, working with the Finance Committee right now before we sign off on those numbers, but so grateful to so many of you for making that last contribution to help us end our fiscal year successfully, and again, making it possible for students to come to programs like this without charge. Also want to thank Ricky Callahan with the City of Dallas, who's with us, a council member. He's got lots of challenges, as we all know, at City Council, so I'm very glad that he's taking a break tonight. Pray for you. Maybe you need your own Rasputin over there. Want to remind you, too, that Tom Pickering is coming on our website. It says sold out, but we've had a few cancellations. If you'd like to hear Tom Pickering, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, India, Jordan, El Salvador, and I probably left off two or three other countries, just call Alana or Rachel tomorrow or let them know that you'd like to hear Tom Pickering. He'll be talking about U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And somebody will probably want to ask him, since he was general senior advisor at Boeing, what he thinks about somebody's tweet today. That's all I'll say on that matter. On December 12th in Fort Worth and December 13th in Dallas, we will welcome Stephen Breyer, a Supreme Court Justice, and that'll be a very exciting program, and we still do have some seats for that. You can tweet, although I don't know why you'd want to, so if you're not, would you please turn off your cell phone and remember to turn it on after tonight's event? And ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Cameron now, who will introduce Douglas Smith.
Good evening. On behalf of partners at PwC, I'm happy to introduce Douglas Smith tonight. As Jim said, Randall Justice came back tonight and is unable to join, and I'm happy to be here because he's invited me to join for all three of the Russia events, but this is the only one I've been in town for. So while Randall can't be here, I am. So Douglas is going to speak to us on one of the most controversial figures in history, which is Rasputin. Doug has extensive experience in all things connected to Russia. In the 80s, he was a Russian-speaking guide on the U.S. State Department's Information USA, which traveled throughout the Soviet Union. He also served as interpreter for the late President Reagan. He studied German and Russian at the University of Vermont and has a doctorate in history from UCLA. In his new book, Rasputin, Faith, Power, and the Twilight of the Romanovs, Douglas seeks to separate myth and fact about Rasputin. 100 years after his death, there are still innumerable questions about Rasputin's life. Smith has enjoyed access to forgotten documents from archives across seven countries. As the noted author Ken Kalfas puts it, Smith's research is comprehensive to the nth degree. He has dug up previously unseen archives, followed previously unexplored leads, and connected the dots across the Russian landscape. Douglas uses those connections to great effect, composing both a comprehensive and powerful narrative. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Douglas Smith.
Thank you very much. First of all, can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay. I was giving a talk once in New York, and I thought I was doing a pretty good job, only to have a voice ring out from the dark after a few minutes. You see that thing in front of your face? It's called a microphone. Why don't you use it? So I always now check. Thanks, Cameron, for that introduction. Thanks again for your organization's support of these talks. Jim, thank you as well, and Alana Bonrostro for all of her organizational wizardry that got me here and got everything organized. Thanks to the World Affairs Council for inviting me here, and thank you all for coming out. There's a million and one things we could be doing with our time, and it's always wonderful to see folks that turn up to learn a bit about something obscure like this man over here, or maybe not so obscure. It's my second trip here to Dallas. I'm still sort of learning the ways of your wonderful city. Went out with a friend for some lunch today, and he ordered the chicken. Seemed like a safe bet, and then it arrived with a can of Budweiser coming out the rear end, which was nothing I'd seen before. It must have been good, though, because he didn't share it with me. So anyway, on a obviously much more serious note, Dallas is also known as the site of one of the worst assassinations in the 20th century. But I'd like to start off tonight by talking about another assassination, political murder, that was, I would argue, much more significant for world affairs. And I'm going to be showing pictures, so don't forget to look over here to the right. There is our friend and subject for this evening. It was exactly 100 years ago this very month, December 1916, that Rasputin visited the Petrograd palace of Prince Felix Yusupov. It was his last social visit ever. And a lot of you no doubt have heard the story of Rasputin's murder, how he was nearly impossible to kill. They put potassium cyanide in some sweet cakes. They put potassium cyanide in his wine. They shot him. They beat him. They threw his body in the back of a car, drove it out to this bridge over an icy branch of the Neva River, threw him in, and even when he hit the water, he was still alive, still breathing, and managed to make the sign of the cross as he finally went under. His murderers, Prince Felix Yusupov, Grand Duke Dmitry Pavlovich, a cousin of the Tsar Nicholas II, the right-wing political figure Vladimir Purashkevich, were motivated by a variety of matters and subjects that led to that gruesome murder that night. Russia had been drifting into chaos for the last 2 years. The war had not gone well against Germany and Austria-Hungary. There was a sense of chaos, a morass of problems sweeping across all of Russia. Many Russians came to believe that the cause for their problems must be traitors among their midst, that they themselves could not really be responsible for the horrific turn that their country had taken, that it must be some sort of fifth column, agents in support of the Kaiser. And so they believed that the way to save Russia was to do away with the figure at the center of the spy network. And they were convinced that by killing Rasputin, they would deal a fatal blow to Germany and its operations within Russia and give the Tsar the chance to finally take the country back and lead Russia to victory in the war. But in fact, the opposite thing happened. Far from putting an end to the chaos sweeping across Russia, the murder of Rasputin sped up the forces of anarchy and chaos. And within a few months, the Romanov dynasty fell. The poet Alexander Bloch put it perfectly when he wrote, "The bullet that killed Rasputin struck the very heart of the reigning dynasty." Grigory Yefimovich Rasputin, as he's called in Russian, was one of the most famous, if not notorious, figures, not only in Russian history of the 20th century, but of the 20th century as a whole. Here is a photograph, probably the earliest existing photograph that we have, taken probably just around the turn of the century, where he's already started to strike that iconic pose that he would repeat in photo after photo. Obviously, Rasputin is littered all across popular culture. Those of a certain generation may remember the classic 1970s disco hit from Boney M. with the refrain, rah-rah Rasputin, rah-rah-rah lover of the Russian queen, rah-rah-rah Rasputin, Russia's greatest love machine. If you have not heard it, I suggest you check it out on YouTube. But there's, I think, other even better Rasputin songs. One of my favorites that I managed to find on CD was from a group called the Three Keys, and they had a 1933 hit called Rasputin, that highfalutin loving man. And it told the story of a crazy lover named Rasputin Jones, and it included this lovely line, "Can't you tell he's from the South? See that gold mine in his mouth?" You can find that if you look hard. There are Rasputin bars, there are Rasputin restaurants, cafes. Anybody familiar with Berkeley knows the Rasputin music store. There's obviously Rasputin vodka, Rasputin cigarettes. There's a Rasputin imperial stout brewed out in California. Rasputin figures in comic books, in Japanese manga and anime. There's even high culture Rasputin in opera and classical music. And of course, there are a number of films about Rasputin. Here's one of the recent ones, a dreadful attempt to capture Rasputin's life and legend, starring Gerard Depardieu as our star. Terrible casting. Rasputin was thin, wiry, elastic, lithe, quick, and instead they picked this lumbering whatever to try. It didn't work. Anyway, don't bother to see it. And then, of course, some of you may know the 1997 Warner Brothers animated classic Anastasia that gave us this version of Rasputin. The story of Rasputin reads like a dark fairy tale. An obscure, uneducated peasant from the wilds of Siberia receives a calling from God and sets out in search of the true faith. A journey that leads him across the vast expanses of Russia for many years before finally bringing him to the palace of the Tsar. The royal family takes him in and is bewitched by his piety, his unerring insights into the human soul, and his simple peasant ways. Miraculously, he saves the life of the heir to the throne, but the presence of this outsider and the influence he wields with the Tsar and the Tsaritsa angers the great men of the realm, and they lure him into a trap, and they kill him. Many believe that the holy peasant had foreseen his death and prophesied that should anything happen to him, the Tsar would lose his throne. And so he does, and the kingdom he once ruled is plunged into unspeakable bloodletting and misery for years. Now, Rasputin has not been overlooked by historians and biographers. The Library of Congress online catalog lists 153 titles on Rasputin, the so-called mad monk and the holy devil. He has clearly not suffered from a lack of attention. So for anyone to think that they're going to take on Rasputin again and add 154th book to the bookshelves has to have a good reason for doing so. I personally never had any interest in Rasputin all the years that I've been studying Russia and writing books about Russia. I had never planned to do it. But my previous book, which was called Former People, told the story of what happened to the Russian nobility after the revolution of 1917. And while I was researching that book, I had to read a great deal about the final years of Tsarist Russia. And I was shocked that everywhere I looked, everything I read, no matter what sort of source it seemed to be, there was Rasputin. He seemed to be everywhere, hovering over the country like some sort of a dark presence. And my curiosity was piqued, and I decided to dig in and try to learn a little bit more about this man. I started reading some of the many, many, many biographies about him. And I came away with a sense that none of them, as I understood it, really seemed to capture who this person was. I found that they were very sort of two-dimensional, sometimes even cartoonish. They sort of gave a depiction of Rasputin that didn't really seem to reflect a real man, but more sort of a myth of an outlandish figure. I also started to read current Russian writings about Rasputin, and there I was struck by something that I had never expected. If in the West, scholars and historians have written about Rasputin as the personification of evil, about Satan incarnate, modern-day right-wing nationalist Russian historians have inverted the pluses and minuses in Rasputin's story and depict him as a true holy man, as a true godlike figure, and a saint who deserves to be canonized in the Russian church. So I was left with then these two very different, very opposing views of who Rasputin might have been. And of course, then I thought, okay, this is a perfect opening for a historian. There's got to be a road somewhere down the middle between these two extremes. I knew, though, if I was going to do Rasputin and to do him properly, that I couldn't simply retell the recycled stories that you read in book after book after book. That's something that wouldn't really add to what we already know and wouldn't be pleasing for me as somebody who likes to think they're getting a bit closer to the truth. I'm somebody who loves archives and could live in an archive if I were allowed to. And I realized that what I had to do if I was going to do this is to go spend a great deal of time in various archives throughout Russia and other parts of the world. Now, while I was working on the book, I would often meet people and they'd ask what I do and I would tell them and talk about my travels and they would say, well, surely this is all online. I live in Seattle, so that's the natural reaction there. And I'd say, no, none of this is online. It's all in archives. And I ended up over 6 years traveling all across Russia and Siberia. I spent various amounts of time in cities throughout Western Europe, from Berlin to Vienna and Paris, places in the UK, and archives here in the United States, the Bakhmetyev Archive at Columbia University, and the incredibly fabulous Hoover Institution Archive out at Stanford. And I came away with a wealth of new material and was astounded by the amount of information I was able to find about his life that had never made it into any of the existing books that we had up till now. And I could go on for 3 or 4 hours tonight, but I was told that's over budget. So I'm going to cut it down and give you just a few ideas of some of the things that I found that I think add to our understanding of Rasputin and who he was. Referring back to the story of the assassination was this idea that Rasputin was a spy, that he was working on behalf of the Kaiser against the Russians in World War I. Now, this is a story that's often repeated. And I realized that if there's an answer to this story, it has to be found in Germany. So I went and I spent a week in Berlin, and I worked in the political archive of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, going, wondering if I could find anything that would finally give us some full answer to the story of Rasputin the spy. And it was amazing, because no other biographers had bothered to go there. And sure enough, I was amazed to find a huge amount of archival documents generated by the German government during World War I on Rasputin. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs was obsessed with Rasputin in 1915, 1916, desperate trying to figure out, was he loyal to the Tsar and to Russia? Was he willing to help make a separate peace with Germany? What was his attitude about the Allies, the English and the French? And also, how could they perhaps make contact with Rasputin and win him over to their side? Was it through money? Was it through women? What were the angles? And they actually had agents in places like Sweden and Switzerland, in neutral countries, meeting with Russians, traveling through, trying to gather every bit of evidence they could to figure out exactly who Rasputin was and whether or not they could put him to use. It was amazing amount of material. And it was remarkable because it showed that, yes, the Germans were fascinated with Rasputin, but there was nothing at all to say that he ever had any contact with them as an agent or had been spying on their behalf. So it was a way of, like, blowing up one of these long-held myths. Now, that's the way things go when you're lucky. It doesn't always work that way. In one of the main archives in Moscow, in the State Archive of the Russian Federation, are enormous police files on Rasputin. The Tsar's secret police, the Okhrana, tailed Rasputin wherever he went and even followed all the people that he had contact with. At one time, they had as many as 5,000 police agents monitoring Rasputin and all of his known associates. So I realized that I could not write this book unless I got access to these police files. So I was going to Moscow regularly, and I'd go to the archive, and I'd put in my request to see the police files. And every time I would do it, my request would come back the next day. Nothing happens real fast there. And it would always say, files are with the director. And I would ask the nice people working in the archive, what does that mean, they're with the director? The files are with the director. And this would go over and over. So I made 3 or 4 trips in a row in 1 year to this archive. Each time I was told the exact same thing. I became very frustrated and very concerned that I would not be able to finish the book. I happened to be in the UK giving a talk at a literary festival there. And after it, a young woman came up to me to thank me for my talk, and she started speaking to me. I immediately detected a Russian accent. And she said, so tell me, what are you working on now? And I said, well, I'm trying to write a biography of Rasputin, but I'm having a really difficult time. She said, well, what's wrong? And I told her the story of the files and everything. And she said, what archive are they in? I said, the State Archive of the Russian Federation. She goes, oh, the director's my godfather. I nearly melted right there, started twitching and sweating. I said, you've got to be joking. Sergei Mironenko is your godfather? Yes, Seryozha, my good godfather Seryozha. So I said, would you be willing to help me? She said, yes. So she emailed her godfather to tell him all about me, and sure enough, I went straight back to Moscow. This time I was shown directly into the director's office. And sure enough, there were the files, like from the rostrum, the podium down there, up to about here. And I saw them, and literally, I was my eyes bulging and, you know, heart palpitating. I was like, I'm finally going to get to see them. The director, though, kept wanting to talk to me, and I was kind of looking at the files, saying, that's all nice, but let's get to the files. So he did say, yes, you can see them, but I'm only giving you 2 days. Now, you're not allowed to Xerox, you're not allowed to photocopy, you're not allowed to take pictures with your phone. So I spent 2 days typing as fast as I could, going through as much of this material that was possible within the short amount of time I had. And it was a treasure of things. I'll give you just one example of what I found there, the kinds of things that make it necessary to spend time in archives, I think, to write good books. An iconic story in the Rasputin biography is that in March of 1915, Rasputin took the train from Petrograd to Moscow. And while he was in Moscow, he and some of his friends went to a restaurant called the Yar. And at the Yar, Rasputin proceeded to get terribly drunk, began acting outlandishly. He began pawing the girls in the gypsy chorus. He began harassing the other patrons in the restaurant. And then when you thought it couldn't get any worse, he jumped up on the table, dropped his trousers, exposed himself to everyone around, and said, this is the altar before which the Empress prays. Now, it seems unbelievable. It really does. But it's repeated in every book as proof of his debauchery, his mendacity, his drunkenness, and also the degree to which he had Nicholas and Alexandra under his thumb and had complete control over the royal couple. Well, what was amazing is in these police files was all the stuff that went on that week in Moscow. And what's remarkable is as I read all the police reports as they followed him around, sure enough, he did go to the Yar restaurant, but in the detailed dispatches of the agents who are watching him, there's not a single sentence about him getting drunk, about him pawing the girls in the gypsy chorus, and definitely not about that third part, which I won't repeat for obvious reasons. And it was remarkable. I'm reading it and saying, well, this doesn't make sense. It's only 2 months later when the chief of police in Petrograd, the capital, a man who had decided that his life work was going to be destroying Rasputin, decided he needed a scandal. And he, in a sense, ordered his underlings in Moscow to fabricate with their police documents and their stamps papers that would claim this scandal had happened. And they invented it out of whole cloth. And obviously, for anyone who's spent a lot of time in Russia knows, when the boss that high up tells you to do something, you do something. And they did it. His name was Junkovsky, the head of the police. He took these bogus documents to Nicholas and said, it grieves me. This brings me no pleasure, Your Majesty, but I must inform you what Rasputin has been up to in Moscow. Nicholas took the reports, thanked him, wasn't sure what really to do, showed them to Alexandra, and Alexandra, to her credit, took one look at him and said, it's all a bunch of lies. And soon after that, Junkowski lost his job. Now, this was sort of one of these eureka, aha moments for a historian. You feel like, oh my God, I've really made a discovery. But I had a problem. There was a British diplomat in Moscow at the time, a man by the name of Bruce Lockhart, who later published his memoirs. And in his memoirs, he claimed that he had been in Moscow at the time, and he had seen this behavior with his own eyes. So I was stumped, because I felt like I had all I needed to dispel of this myth. But I knew there would be some reader of my book out there who would know about Lockhart's memoirs and say, Smith is lazy. He didn't do his homework, and he didn't read the Lockhart memoirs. So I said, okay, how do I solve this? How do I get around the Lockhart memoirs? So I did a bit of digging, and fortunately, I was living in London at the time, and I found out that Lockhart's personal papers all ended in the archive of the Palace of Westminster there in London. So I shot over to the Palace of Westminster, requested his files and documents, and what did I find? His diaries from 1915. And guess what? In March of 1915, Lockhart wasn't even in Moscow. He was in Kiev, and there's no mention of any scandal. So again, it goes to show you can't believe not only what's online, you can't believe what's in a lot of British diplomats' publications. Now, not only do I go to archives, I'm one of these biographers, I like to go to the places connected with my subjects' lives. And here I am, I brought that up a little bit prematurely just to whet your appetite, in western Siberia in the village of Pokrovskaya, which was where Rasputin was born and where he always maintained a home and his family lived and to where he always returned. So I went out to Pokrovskaya to poke around to see what it looked like, what it felt like, what the sky was like, the river Tura that flows by, just kind of soak it up. I also had to go because there is a Rasputin museum there founded by a couple who are more fanatical about Rasputin than even I am, located directly across the street from where Rasputin's house used to be. So I got to tour the museum and meet this lovely couple and see all their exhibits. Here's the author. In the museum, they made me sit in this chair. They claimed that this had been in the Rasputin household and that if you sat in it, men would be guaranteed lifelong virility. You have to talk to my wife if you want to know more about that. I went to his apartment, one of the last apartment he lived in Petrograd. It's on Gorokhovaya Street, number 64. Unlike, say, London, you don't have a lot of blue plaques there to designate this house, but there is a Rasputin hair salon in the bottom. The gate to go in was locked, so I waited around until somebody came out and made my way up to the third floor, and there is the door to Rasputin's apartment. Of course, I had to go to the scene of the murder. This is in the cellar of the Yusupov Palace in Petersburg. I'm the one on the right. staged in a very cheesy manner with a wax figure of Rasputin there and, you know, the supposed sweets poisoned and the poisoned wine and what have you. This is the side of the Yusupov Palace, and it was most likely through that door that Rasputin, bleeding badly from several gunshots, tried to make his way out and escape the Yusupov Palace across this courtyard and out to the Moika Street and flee for his life. It's remarkable in that the courtyard where I'm standing now, where this horrific, bloody murder scene took place, is now the playground for a kindergarten. And it was so utterly strange to see these little Russian children playing games. And they had a little swing set and a little slide, and obviously oblivious to, you know, the significance of the ground that they were running around. It was kind of jarring. I also went out, excuse me, to Tsarskoye Selo, where the Tsar's summer palace was outside the city. After his murder, Rasputin was buried out there before being dug up not long after the Russian Revolution. And some sort of amateur historians have put up this memorial there to the gravesite. When I came upon it, there was this woman there all by herself who was praying and sobbing heavily. And I finally went up and asked her if everything was all right, if I could do anything for her. And she kept saying, "Griech, griech, the sin, the sin." And she was telling me about the sin that the Russian people had for their connection to the murder of Rasputin and the royal family. I didn't have the heart to tell her that that was probably not where he was buried, but in fact, it was somewhere out in this field, a little further on. I think the amateur historians were a little too amateur. But this is where people who really know the story of what happened to his body think that Rasputin was most likely originally buried. So I went and I traipsed around the field, but didn't turn anything up. Here's a picture of Rasputin in the palace from approximately 1909 with the royal family. That's Grand Duchesses Maria Tatiana from left to right on the ground with their nursemaid Maria Vishnyakova. And then in the middle row is Anastasia, Rasputin, and then the Empress Alexandra, little Alexei, and then in the back is Grand Duchess Olga. So what have I uncovered after the 6 years of traipsing around, researching, and writing? What is new in my book that maybe hasn't been there before? I think I've done a good job of trying to get us away from this idea of Rasputin the devil and Rasputin the saint, and to develop a much more complex, well-rounded, really true-to-life figure of a man. I have not tried to whitewash the negative sides, and sure, there are many of them. He did become a horrible drunk. He womanized. He probably picked up prostitutes on his trips to Petersburg. He had an anger. He could rage. He was vain, and he was ambitious. But there were other sides to him that I came in contact with that I hadn't expected to see, and allowed me to kind of understand him in I think, a more positive, a more beneficial light. One thing is interesting, he was never greedy. He was never interested in money, in wealth, and property, which he never really acquired. He didn't seek out noble titles or medals or promotions. He always kept his connections to his life back in Pokrovskaya in western Siberia, where he was from, and he kept his connections to the peasant class. He even was, I would say, in some ways, a good family man. He did take care of his wife, Praskovia. He had three children. He took the two daughters to Petersburg, tried to give them the best possible education. He worried about their dating. I even found, materials on his concern over who his daughter Maria might want to marry and that sort of thing. When his son Dmitry was drafted into World War I, he was devastated, terribly fearful that he would be killed, and made sure that he was stationed with a hospital train in the rear. I also came away very much convinced that he truly believed in the teachings of the gospel, that his embrace of Orthodox Christianity was not a sham, it was not a sort of a tool of self-promotion, but it was something he believed in deeply. One of the things that led me to this conviction was in the summer of 1914, as Russia and much of Europe was heading headlong into war. It was Rasputin who was doing whatever he could to talk Nicholas out of war. And there's an amazing letter that's now at the Yale University in the Beinecke Rare Book Library all about trying to convince Nicholas not to go to war. And I could go on more about that. But he was truly a man of peace, and he was one who really spoke up for religious tolerance, both towards Jews, who he came to befriend in his later years, and towards Muslims within the Russian Empire. So in that way, he's much more complex, he's much more nuanced, I think, than we've seen. I also came away with a new understanding of his relationship to the people around him. Typically, it's been argued that a corrupt, debauched Rasputin comes to the capital, and his perversion sort of pollutes what was once a clean and moral and upstanding society. But the more I looked at it and the more I read, the more I came to the conclusion that it was the other way around, that it was Petersburg society that corrupted Rasputin and not vice versa. Obviously, this hinges then on the gruesome murder of Rasputin. I think you can see in what Prince Yusupov and the others did that December night was a symbol of the moral bankruptcy of Russian society before the collapse of the Romanovs, that they dared to invite an innocent man under false pretenses to a party with the plans to murder him in cold blood. Returning to the murder, returning to the story of how he died, this is an amazing photograph in an autopsy file in a Petersburg museum that I saw that has several pictures of Rasputin as he was plucked out of the river and then laid out for an autopsy. The story that we've heard about Rasputin and how he was murdered, that he was satanic in his strength and thus impossible to kill, was just one of the many myths that have developed around him. And it's one of the myths that I try to unpack and deconstruct, show how it's not true, and get to what I think really happened that night in the cellar of the Yusupov Palace. But to learn that, you'll have to read the book. Thank you.
Take some questions. Right back there. And I think we have a microphone. If you would identify yourself, please.
Yes, Bruce Westray, St. Mark's School. First of all, I'd like to know if it's true that Lionel Barrymore's portrayal of Rasputin is what's responsible for the disclaimer in movies these days about actors being portrayed not representing real people, because one of the Romanovs was mightily offended by the film. I've heard that story. And I also wondered if it was also true, I think I read this in Peter Massey's treatment, that he did have some sort of curative ability with the Tsarevich.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so the first question, yes, if you watch a movie now, any movie made, at least in the U.S., there's always a disclaimer. You know, any persons or events portrayed in this film are entirely fictional and, you know, no connection to true life. That, in fact, is a result of the Barrymore's film about Rasputin. All three of the Barrymores starred in the film. And it wasn't the Romanovs who sued. It was Prince Yusupov himself, who felt that the film depicted his wife, Irina, in a negative life, and he negative light. And he sued, and he did win. And so, henceforth, films have you know, borne that statement at the end as a way of, you know, the lawyers getting their 2 cents in worth to protect themselves. Yusupov, after the revolution, had lost everything, and the main reason that for the suit was not because he was so terribly offended by the depiction, but he sensed a good way to make some money, and he came out on top on that one. In terms of Rasputin's ability to heal the suffering of the heir to the throne, the Tsarevich Alexei, that is one of these mysteries that I struggled with mightily in trying to figure out what that might have been. There are all sorts of theories about whether it was the power of prayer, the penetrating gaze of his eyes, the magnetic touch of his hands. I ultimately came down on sort of two things, and I'm not the first to come down with this interpretation. Others have suggested it. Robert Massey kind of hints at it in his book, Nicholas and Alexandra, that, first of all, Rasputin told the doctors to get away. And obviously the son was a hemophiliac, and the more the doctors prodded and, you know, poked him and everything, the harder it was for the body to heal. The blood wouldn't coagulate. So he told him to get away. But I think a second piece that was important, and this gets into the connection between mind-body, and the degree to which the mind controls physiological processes, and the degree to which the mind shapes pain and shapes healing. And this is now obviously cutting-edge science. Places like UCLA and Harvard and other places have institutes now studying what is the mind-body connection in health. I think, and just to be brief so we can get to other questions, He literally helped will him to health, calm the breathing, calm the blood flow, by insisting to him with great confidence, you will be well. And I'll leave it at that because you can follow up on the book.
David Gleason, I understand that Rasputin had very little, if any, formal education, but he was obviously became educated. Could you maybe delve into that a little bit about how and where and when?
Exactly. You know, peasants in Russia were not typically literate. I mean, the illiteracy rate in sort of mid-19th century Russia among the peasant class was probably over 95%. There's an amazing chapter of his life. When he was about 28 years old, Rasputin, who had lived as a regular peasant up till then, became what the Russians call a stranik, which is a holy pilgrim. He had some sort of a religious experience, and he set off wandering across Russia, going from monastery to monastery, church to church, trying to become spiritually enlightened through engagement with priests and secular holy men. And it was through this years of traveling that he did then learn the rudiments of reading and writing, and he came to almost know the Gospels by memory. He could cite, you know, scripture and verse over and over, and mix it with this sort of lively peasant language and peasant vitality that a well-educated church figure was unable to do. And so he did write. We do have his writings. We have his notes and his letters. They're almost impossible to read, A, between his handwriting, and between B, the bizarre way in which he used language. And oftentimes, to understand what he's doing, I'd have to consult some of my friends in Moscow who are historians and say, you know, what is he trying to say here? And even they would have to spend some time on it. Mm-hmm.
What was the nature of Rasputin's relationship with Alexandra?
That's another good question. Alexandra is a fascinating figure and a tragic figure. She was a profoundly mystical person, profoundly religious person, and somebody who needed a figure like Rasputin to sort of keep her somewhat balanced, if you will. Part of this was due to the illness of her son, and she felt terribly guilty that she had brought this boy into the world with this affliction. But part of it was her own internal concerns about reality and trying to make sense of her life as the empress. And a third part that I think was really important that hasn't been written about a lot is she loved Nicholas profoundly, but she also recognized that her husband was a very weak man, and that he was easily dominated by the men at court, by ministers, by generals, and high officials. And she looked to Rasputin to be, if you will, a surrogate backbone for her husband. And if you read the correspondence between Alexandra and Nicholas, it's amazing how she is constantly telling her husband Nicholas, listen to our friend, as they called Rasputin. Listen to our friend. Do as he says. He's there to help you. He is wise. She would even engage in these utterly bizarre practices like sending her husband Rasputin's comb. And she would write to Nicholas, you're going to meet with the ministers and generals tomorrow. Be sure you go before the meeting to a room by yourself and brush for a half an hour your beard and hair with our friend's comb. Only then will you have the will and the power to resist their bad influence. So I think that was a crucial element of their relationship.
My name's Robert Potter. If he was a peasant, a monk, clergyman, what did he do that gave him access to the Tsar and to the royal family?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Obviously, you know, Nicholas and Alexandra, they already had their own confessor. They had connections with top church officials. But the Russian church, much of the Russian church at the time, was almost more a bureaucratic branch of the government than a profoundly spiritual institution, if you will. And not only Nicholas and Alexandra, but much of educated Russian society was hungry for what they thought would be a more authentic religious experience. And they looked to these figures from the peasant class who, while they were not trained in theological seminaries, were believed to be much more honest, direct, inspired messengers of God. And so when Nicholas and Alexandra met Rasputin in 1905, they felt that they were somehow being put in touch with the vast peasant masses of Russia, and that when he spoke to them, it wasn't just one man, but it was all of peasant Russia that was speaking. So, you know, they were very isolated in the palace. They were very cut off from connection to the country over which they ruled. And allowing someone like Rasputin into their palace, into their private rooms, was a way of trying to bridge that gap, was a way of trying to make contact with, you know, that huge Russia out there. And one thing that Rasputin always did was he was always very blunt with them, and they liked this, because Alexandra said, you know, if I ask one of the ministers or I ask one of my priests, you know, what should I do or what do you think, the answer would always be, as it please your majesty. And she said, that's not what I want, you know. I want you to tell me what the truth is. And Rasputin was somebody, he was never, like, overawed by their power. He respected and worshipped the monarchy, but he would go in there and he would say, you know, you're wrong, or that's foolish, or don't do that. Or towards the end of the dynasty, Rasputin, to his credit, was telling Nicholas and Alexandra, the people in the city are hungry. There's bread lines. There's food lines. This is dangerous. You need to do something. So he, at times, gave them very good advice. It's just too bad that Nicholas didn't listen to him the times that he was being accurate.
But how did they pick him out from the alternatives?
Okay, why Rasputin and why not somebody else? Well, there's a fascinating chapter pre-Rasputin. There was a French charlatan by the name of Monsieur Philippe who met close members of the Romanov family. And this Monsieur Philippe claimed that he could predict the future. He claimed that he could make mesmeric movements of his hands over Alexandra's womb and produce an heir. And they embraced all this. I mean, it was truly wacko land. I mean, for lack of a better term. The degree to which mysticism was so powerful at the last court. And they were very drawn to the ideas of this Monsieur Philippe and his ideas about what was the future for the country, for Russia and all this. He became too scandalous for the Romanovs to keep around, and he had to go back to France. But before he went back to France, Philippe said to Alexandra Nicholas, just you wait. A friend will come to you. He will come after me, and you will recognize him and, you know, be prepared. And so they were already looking for somebody like this. And the same relatives that had introduced this Monsieur Philippe to Nicholas and Alexandra came in contact with Rasputin through a high-placed bishop in Petersburg. And they were impressed by his spirituality, by his vision, by his sort of charismatic power. And they then brought him to the palace, sort of as a curiosity kind of thing. But also the thinking being, if we can introduce a figure to the royal couple and he takes hold, he will also then be our creature as well, and it gains us greater access to the palace.
You know, your book just arrived a few days ago, and I just had a chance to look at it briefly today at lunch. But where I turned, you were talking about the role that he played in affecting some of the battles. Could you talk about that?
Right. Well, at times he offered very good advice about, you know, trying to stay out of going into World War I. He tried to get Nicholas to stay out of the Balkan Wars, which were just before World War I. But once the war started, Rasputin supported the war wholeheartedly and was always giving Nicholas encouragement that Russia would be victorious because, of course, God was on their side, right? That's what every side says. God's on my side. God's on my side. And he was convinced that God was on the side of Orthodox Russia. But he would go beyond that, and he would, towards the latter months of his life, was offering all sorts of bizarre suggestions and advice on things he really knew nothing about. Like he was trying to counsel Nicholas, like on how the nascent Air Force should be organized and what kind of planes they should have. He would say, you know, I had a vision of Sun in the southeast, thinking that would be a good place for them to attack with their troops and things like that. So he went way too far on numerous occasions with his advice on the conduct of the war. Most of this stuff, though, Nicholas simply chose to ignore.
And before we end, I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask you to comment on how you see the relations between the United States and Russia proceeding with President-elect Trump and Vladimir Putin.
It's getting really late. Was that, are you serious, or was that?
I'm serious.
Oh.
We've asked everybody that. Let's see what you say.
That is, wow. I have to be careful what I say.
House rules.
If I were in a position of authority, in my opinion, Russia has weapons, and Russia has oil. In my opinion, they have great culture, music, literature. They don't offer us anything other than that. I'm somebody who would tend to be more on the hawkish side. I would try to isolate them, and I would try to keep them at bay. I personally think we underestimate just how truly, in my opinion, nasty, criminal, dangerous the Putin regime is. Putin has destroyed civil society. He's destroyed true plurality of political parties. I think, in my opinion, anything we can do to try to contain them and hold them off is the way we should go. But I realize that a lot of people disagree with that.
Thank you very much, Douglas Smith.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before you leave, Douglas, I want to present you with the official World Affairs Council. I'm glad to see not all authors wear neckties. You wear one from time to time.
Oh, thank you.
Please enjoy. This represents on here all the cities that have diplomatic representation here in Dallas-Fort Worth. As I said, I really did just get the book a day or two ago and read it for about a half an hour at lunch and just loved it. And then I was looking on the back in the reviews from people like Robert Massey and Robert Service and other folks who have written really important historical books, nonfiction on Russia, just give it rave reviews. Also looked at some of the reviews you got in the New York Times and New York Review of Books. This is a book that if you really want to understand what happened in the Russian Revolution and clearly the character of Rasputin, you'll enjoy reading it. It reads easily, even though it's 700 pages.
670.
So you'll spend some time visiting with folks, signing their books.
Then
we have the Contributor Circle dinner across the hall. In the garden room. And again, if you'd like to come here, Ambassador Pickering, just call the office or tell Alana or Rachel tonight. Thanks for being with us. See you again soon.